Well, good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues, though it's gotten rather quiet. Pelosi's standing pat on her decision not to send the impeachment forward to the Senate. So we'll have to see how that goes. On another front, ask yourself this. How can somebody just vanish? Never to be seen again. Leaving only the smallest of clues behind. Clues that actually just simply lead to more questions. Now, in this particular case, attorney goes to work. He's the first person on the scene. And he discovered his assistant, who should already be sitting at her desk, was missing. And laying on her desk was a paperback romance novel, open to a page where the heroine is violently abducted. Interestingly enough, the woman who was reading the book seems to have been violently abducted. Well, if she had to leave, she always left a note. And there was no note. So the attorney knew something was wrong. Now, I'm going to add to that, a few days before her disappearance, someone had spray-painted a message on the wall opposite the office declaring their undying love for her in a very public way. And that young, single woman, that secretary, was so alarmed by this that her firm had a panic button installed by her desk, and she kept the office doors locked all the time. Now, this was the summer of 1981, and the location was East Manhattan. Now, if you never lived in Manhattan, that is a very interesting town. It's wall-to-wall people. Now, at that time, the area of East Manhattan was an area of high crime, and there was even a couple of serial killers wandering around plying their trade. Now, years later, a woman came forward to explain she was the lady for whom the message had been sprayed on the wall. Had the same first name as the woman who vanished from the office, and it was her boyfriend who had written the message. Even showed police his handwriting as proof it was him. But at the time the young lady disappeared, nobody knew this. They assumed the message was directed at the secretary. And there were reports of strange phone calls as well. It was said she'd been receiving disturbing phone calls that ranged from silent to threatening. But she'd never say exactly what was said in the phone calls, but she was visibly shaken after each one. And she always had an expression of horror on her face whenever she got one of those calls. Well, the day that she disappeared, her boss arrived and found the front door locked, as was her habit. But she wasn't inside. Neither was her handbag or her keys. Now, about 4 or 5 weeks later, the police got an anonymous tip. A woman was being held prisoner in the basement of a house close by. But in spite of diligent follow-up, they didn't find anything. Her boss was arrested 15 years later and sent to prison for joining forces with a client he was defending on drug supply charges. Turns out he'd been working with that criminal to acquire and sell drugs. And over the years since Cindy Anderson went missing, people speculated about what could have happened to her. Had she learned about her boss's involvement in the drug trade? Was that why she was silenced? Was her disappearance the work of organized criminals working in conjunction with her boss? And who was calling and scaring her? And why had a book been left on her desk describing an abduction scene? Did she have a stalker that nobody knew about or that she wouldn't tell about? Who took her? Why did they take her? More important, where did they take her? She still hadn't been found despite police having folders full of details about her and having conducted a long and dedicated search for her. Her whereabouts is still a mystery. There was another case involving Michelle Palumbo. It raised in Tucson, but she left there and went to live with her grandparents in Reno in 2000. When she arrived in Reno, Nevada, which is an interesting town, she managed to find a job in a pawn shop, and she was described to everybody as cheerful and helpful. About that same time, she developed a very dangerous habit. Took methamphetamine. Was thought this expensive drug habit would lead her into another profession. One described as dangerous as her drug habit. There were those that thought she turned to prostitution to fund her need for the drug. It was about that time her personality started changing, and she called her mother, telling her she thought people were following her, and she believed her phone was being tapped. She also said she thought her life was in danger. She was planning on coming back home to her mother to escape the dangers that she perceived were all around her. And that was the last time anybody in her family heard from her. Needless to say, she didn't make it back home. In the early hours, a couple of days later, security policemen at the airport spotted a woman hiding behind a truck on the tarmac in a restricted area. He approached her, and she identified herself and said she was looking for somebody. And there was nobody else on the tarmac, and the policeman thought she was probably hallucinating. Put her in his car and drove her to the Hilton Hotel, where he left her outside, expecting her to go check in. But she never did check in, and that was the last time anybody saw her. Next day, her car was discovered abandoned at the airport, and inside was her belongings, as well as $500 in cash and her cell phone. There were also copies of emails she had sent to the U.S. government accusing him of trying to kill her, along with a bizarre drawing of a woman that looked like her who was bound and gagged. Now, there was one possible sighting of her a few months later when the owner of a casino in Reno said they'd seen her there with another identified woman, but said she looked that they'd the two women had left when they'd seen a man looking at him through one of the windows. Nobody knows if it was her or not, and given that she's never contacted her family again, it's likely that wasn't her, in case of mistaken identity. When she disappeared, you have to wonder if she was suffering from some kind of drug-induced paranoia. Had she met the wrong kind of people in her drug dealings? Had she met a client in her line of work that had developed a fixation with her? And most importantly, why does she think the government was trying to kill her? Well, she's another one who's vanished, and nobody has any idea where she went or why she went. Well, let me give you a third example of unexplained disappearance. A young man had a 50-minute telephone call with his father. The last word that the father heard from his son was a swear word uttered in surprise and shock. His son had called him late that evening to say he'd run his car into a dried mud bank and couldn't get it out. Asked his parents to come and get him. It's May of 2008. And the student, whose name was Brandon, had been driving home to Marshall in Minnesota, a rural and mainly agricultural county with wind projects and canals. In fact, he just completed a technical college course in wind turbines. After waiting for a while for his parents to turn up, he became impatient when they told him on the phone they were having trouble locating him. He told him he was going to walk, turn to the nearest town, whose lights were in the distance, and expected to meet him on the way. Well, it would seem that Brandon was probably off in his description of where he thought he was, because no matter how hard his parents looked for him, they couldn't locate him or the car. He continued walking on toward the lights in the distance as his parents searched for him. It was well after midnight, and the young man and his parents stayed in contact throughout. The father kept him talking on the phone. Now, Brandon was positive he knew where he was, and he couldn't understand why his parents couldn't find him. And he was becoming increasingly irritated. Now, his parents had gone to exactly where he said he was, and he was definitely not there. They continued to drive the roads, unable to see him or his car, and then came the swear word in which he sounded suddenly surprised and shocked, and the call went dead. Didn't sound like he'd fallen or tripped. Sounded like he was shocked by something, even horrified by something. But they couldn't imagine what it was. And whatever had happened, Brandon didn't answer the phone again, despite his father constantly calling his number back. Now his parents were concerned. He wasn't answering his phone for some reason, and they had no idea what had just happened to him, where he was, or what might be happening to him. Desperately, they continued to drive around, urgently trying to find his location to get him to answer his phone. And in fact, they proceeded to spend several hours that early morning looking for him. But still, they couldn't find any sign of him or his car. About dawn, they called the police. The search for the student was immediately initiated. Well, until the following day, police were able to locate his missing car. They traced signals received at cell phone towers from his cell phone. The car was about 20 miles from the town the boy had thought he'd been heading toward on foot. He told his parents he was close to the town when he'd called him to come get him, and that was why they couldn't find him that night. He'd been nearly 20 miles away from where he thought he was. He thought the lights he could see on the horizon were the town, but he was wrong. And so while his parents had gone to that location, he'd been wandering around miles away from there. And that explained why they couldn't find him. But it didn't explain why he couldn't be found now. Search party couldn't find him or his cell phone. What investigators started to believe was he'd accidentally walked into and then fallen into the river as he was talking to his father. They thought that would, of course, explain the shock and the swear word. Now, his father wasn't convinced. He said he may have had a drink, and according to the friends he'd been with that evening, he'd been drinking, but definitely not enough for him to have been drunk. And the father said he didn't sound drunk throughout that entire phone conversation. It lasted almost an hour. So it didn't seem plausible to the father that his son would fall in and not be able to get out. Despite an exhaustive search of both the water and the land, the boy just could not be found. Searchers, of course, said the river had been flowing fast at the time and could have swept him away. But the water was extensively searched, and they couldn't find his body or any sign he'd been there. Well, the searches included aerial searches, horseback, ATV, and a lot of friends and volunteers on foot. And they repeatedly covered the ground between where the car had been found and the town. After the official searches ended, his family, along with volunteers, didn't give up and looked for him for a number of weeks. The only clue came from the canine search dogs that seemed to indicate his scent had traveled in one particular direction. But that didn't lead to finding his body, because the scent just stopped. And perhaps that was a clue. He couldn't have gone into the water after all. What did hamper the search efforts, particularly the ability to track his scent, is that area by its nature is one of crisscrossing winds that break up the flow of the scent. Now, it is possible he succumbed to hypothermia, especially if he'd been walking through wet grass and been out in the cold for hours, but it was May, not winter, And even so, they should still have been able to find his body. Then there was the question of why his call ended so abruptly in shock. Did he become involved in an altercation? Was he the victim of foul play? Did somebody arrive there at the scene? Did they kidnap him? Why was his body never found? Well, his heartbroken mother talked to news channels after the incident. She said he wasn't injured. He said he was okay, no damage to his car. Felt confident about where he was, and he was saying that we were lost. But the minute the call dropped, I became sick. I knew it. I knew it was wrong. I knew it was bad. Brandon Swanson had vanished. In fact, he's still missing. Well, let's turn to the Bitterroot Mountains. Barbara Bullock. She was hiking with a friend of hers who'd come to stay with her and her husband. Only him and Barbara had felt like going on the hike that day. And she herself was said to be an experienced hiker, quite familiar with the route she had taken her friend on. She also knew how to take precautions on trips into the wilderness. She carried a Magnum pistol, which she kept in her backpack. They made it up to the peak that morning after a pleasant hike. They were on the descent when he stopped to take in the view. His friend turned his back on her as he took in the beauty of the scenery, and when he turned around, she was gone. He looked all around and still couldn't see his hiking partner, started walking around in confusion, completely baffled. One minute she'd been standing just a few feet away from him, and the next she wasn't there anymore. He looked behind the sparse bushes, shouted her name, turned in every direction, and still couldn't see any sign of her. In panic now, he raced down the trail to find the nearest rangers and the search teams and were brought into the area immediately. The search and rescue effort included trained search dogs and infrared heat-seeking helicopters that scoured the mountainside. It was July 2007, and the weather was just fantastic. No poor visibility, no bad weather to hamper the search. The trail they had taken was only 2.5 miles long. Dad wandered off for miles deep into the wilderness. Her friend described what had happened. She said, I turned to look at a peak off in the distance. My back was only turned to her for a minute. When I turned back around, she was gone. It was about 11:30 in the morning. He managed to get down the trail and find the rangers by about 2:30, which did mean a 3-hour delay, but he said he'd gone as fast as he could after spending a while initially searching by himself and then going 1.5 miles back down to the base of the trail. Now, it wasn't the most remote part of the national park by any means. There were roads that ran through the area, but if Barbara had left, that would have meant she'd have to walk back down the trail alone and would surely have been seen by some of the other hikers if she'd voluntarily walked away. Her friend remembered seeing 2 athletic-looking young men on the trail with a dog, and they could never be traced afterwards. Though there was no suspicion they had anything to do with their disappearance. Instead, they were looked at as potential witnesses. What baffled everybody was the speed at which her friend said she seemed to have vanished from sight. Of course, you have to ask, did he play a part in her disappearance? It was broad daylight on a popular hiking trail. If he pushed her over a crevice, he risked other people witnessing the crime, but even if he had, the heat-seeking helicopter should have found a body signature. Wouldn't the sniffer dogs have picked up her scent and found her? No bad weather to hamper their ability to track her, and still they couldn't lead the search party to her body. Or was she the victim of a silent stalking mountain lion, or was it a silent human predator? She did have a gun, but she didn't have it in her hand. She kept it in her backpack. And if somebody tried to grab her, surely she would have screamed, and her friend was standing just a few feet away. It was an impossible mystery, and it remains just that. She's never been seen again, and her body, despite the most intensive of searches, has never been found. Now, that area was covered by shale, making footsteps noisy. You could not walk silently there, and you couldn't creep up on somebody either. You also couldn't really hide. It was lightly, not heavily forested. There weren't lots of trees and bushes in which to hide or be hidden. And again, while authorities can trace the two men who her friend said they passed on the trail that day, do we even know if she was actually in the park on that particular day? Only her friend corroborated her presence. That doesn't answer, though, why the dogs could find no trace of her at all. If she'd been there, it would seem to me that they would have easily picked up her scent. Well, this next particular case is equally baffling. This young man, his name was Michael, spent the whole night playing computer games with his friends in the college dorm. He'd been playing a computer game with another student via a virtual connection. When they finished the game, they came out of their rooms, congratulated each other, and went back to their own rooms. It was about 4 in the morning in December of 1999 at UCLA. That's about the time they called it a night and went to bed. When his roommate woke up about 9, he noticed that Michael wasn't in his bed. He's quite surprised because they'd only had a few hours sleep, and he didn't think his friend would already have gone out, especially as his wallet and keys were on the table by his bed. Well, nobody's seen him since he came out of his room at 4 that morning, and nobody has a clue what happened to him. Highly experienced lead investigator on the case, William Howell, who was used to dealing with homicides and serious violent crimes, didn't expect this case to affect him so much at the time, but as he talked to newspapers, he expressed his perplexity in the apparent complete lack of clues and the baffling cause of this young man's disappearance. Michael was a laid-back young man with a good grades and a promising musician, had a nice bunch of friends. No evidence suggests any of these friends had played a part in this young man's disappearance. They questioned them all thoroughly, but the detectives got no instinctive feeling that any of them were deceiving him in any way. And there had been no disagreements that night, as far as he could tell. Well, according to the detective, if somebody's planning on disappearing, they usually take something they need. But everything that Michael needed was still inside his room. Every personal item he possessed was still there, including his money. The only possible lead came from witnesses who said they'd seen a male in the dorm hallways they didn't recognize at about 4:30 in the morning. But the problem was the man in the dorm hallway was never identified. He could quite easily have been completely unrelated to the disappearance, and he could come just to visit a friend, but nobody knows for sure who he was. Well, after the initial investigation, the detective changed the investigation from a missing person case to a homicide, because nothing he found made it likely that Michael walked away voluntarily from his happy life. For his family, there was not only the torture of not knowing where he is and what's happened to him, even the offer of a $100,000 reward for information leading to his whereabouts had been left unclaimed. Strangely, the only real lead came when the bloodhounds brought in, tracked his scent out of the room, down the hall, across the street, and down the road to a bus stop, where it ended. But how could he have gotten on the bus at that time of night without his wallet? And were the buses even running at that time? Seems unlikely he caught a bus that morning. Yet you have to ask yourself why his scent was there. Or was it simply there from the day before he disappeared? There wasn't one friend who believed he had simply walked away, got on a bus, and never returned. It made no sense to anybody who knew him, and it also didn't help detectives because this was where the only trail inexplicably ended. Well, this particular case is being treated as a homicide, and with no suspects, it's a case that's incredibly difficult to actively investigate. Detectives are really just waiting for information to come to him. If he's alive now, Mike would be in his 30s. What could possibly have happened to him? Where'd he go? Why'd he go? And who else, if anyone, was involved in this disappearance? These are questions that have never been answered. This next case is fascinating as well. It involves Laura Spearer. Spent the night with friends drinking in a bar in Bloomington, Monroe County, Indiana in 2011. She was 20 years old, a fashion student at the Indiana University. Left her apartment with a friend to go bar hopping. And it was speculated she'd been drinking, possibly taking some kind of drugs prior to leaving their apartment, but there is an enormous amount of conjecture about her case, and facts aren't easy to come by. Apart from the one fact that in the early hours of that morning, she vanished, never to be seen again. Having been drinking quite heavily, according to some witnesses at the bar, she left her cell phone and shoes there and left with a male friend to go back to his apartment to meet up with some more friends there. It was during this time she was captured on CCTV. Male friend was seen to be helping her and even carrying her at one point. Witnesses also said she seemed inebriated, and there were reports from witnesses that she kept falling over. But it seems she left her friend's apartment and was either heading back to her apartment or heading back to the barn when she was last seen about 3 a.m. walking alone. And one camera showed her walking into an empty lot. Well, when she said she's going back home, one of her friends says he walked partly back with her and watched her walking along the sidewalks toward her apartment, which was just a couple of blocks away. But somehow, she never made it back to her apartment. A local homeless man came forward later to say he heard a woman screaming close to where she'd last been seen. And around the time, she would have been walking back. It wasn't known how far the police took this report, and unfortunately, the man died only a couple of days after that, though there's no record of what he died from. Over the following weeks, hundreds of volunteers searched for her. Police questioned every possible suspect. The local landfills were searched. All waterways had divers searching for a body. Tips came in about a body being buried here and there, and police investigated each lead, but they never did discover her body. Now, since her disappearance, the human remains of 5 other people have been found in the county. None were her. Laura is missing still. Now, there were rumors among students and the locals that she'd overdosed due to a rare heart condition at the possible possible combination of drugs in her system. And her friends had panicked and disposed of her body. Well, you have to ask yourself why they wouldn't just call for an ambulance. Others say they couldn't because they were the ones that supplied the drugs. But unfortunately, this is all unfounded speculation because no one really knows what went on that night, and rumors are always wild. Others think she could have become random prey to an opportunist who spotted a very vulnerable and incapacitated woman alone on the streets in the early hours of the morning, when almost everybody else had gone home, and he abducted her quickly with ease. Some point out she wasn't the only one to have gone missing in recent years. Particularly, they mentioned Paige Johnson and Caitlin Markham. So the question is there a serial killer working in the area? You know, the authorities can't help but think some kind of foul play's at the bottom of this lady's disappearance. After all, young women simply can't vanish without her phone, or voluntarily vanish without her phone, money, or a car at 4:30 in the morning. So what happened to Laura? Unfortunately, no one knows. Now, one of the names that I had mentioned, Caitlin Markham, she was a student in Cincinnati. 2 months after the disappearance of Laura. She was dropped off by her boyfriend at a home at about 11 p.m. She had no plans for the rest of the night other than go to bed. Her boyfriend was working that night, and they talked to each other again the next morning, but when he called her, she didn't answer. And he couldn't get hold of her after several attempts, so he figured he'd drive around and catch up with her in person. Well, he got to her house, and although her car was there, she was not. Now, her car shouldn't have been there. It should have been at her workplace where she should have been. But when he called her work, he found out she hadn't shown up there either. Now, inside her house, nothing looked amiss or disorganized, and there was nothing suspicious, except she'd gone out somewhere without her car and a purse when she was supposed to be at work in a store in the mall. Now, she was very close to graduating college, had a trip planned with a boyfriend due to start shortly, and by all accounts had no worries or problems to cause her to voluntarily disappear. Well, nearly 2 years later, remains of her body were found in a creek bed about 26 kilometers from her house. It was in a place that had started being used by locals as an unofficial dumping ground for trash. A person who was picking through the trash saw her skull wrapped in a plastic bag with some hair still on it. Whoever killed her hadn't been identified. In fact, I don't even know for sure how she died. But clearly, for her to wind up in the creek was certainly suspicious. And then there's the disappearance of Paige Johnson. Hers bore an uncanny resemblance to that of Laura Spira. In fact, all the missing women are of short stature, petite, and light in weight, and have very light brown or blonde hair. None of them looked like they'd be able to put up much of a fight against a man if they had to, and frankly, they shouldn't have had to, but many people think there's an evil at play in the form of a man who has no conscience when it comes to this particular type of victim. Paige went missing a year before Laura. She was a young mother with a 2-year-old child. Lived in Kentucky, just over 5 feet tall, and weighed about 100 pounds. Been out with a friend who said he dropped her off about 1 in the morning on September morning in 2010. And that was the last time anybody saw her. Though this acquaintance of hers was arrested and questioned, he wasn't thought to be a person of interest. The Ohio River was only a few blocks away, which has led some to speculate the river could have been her last destination. Now, she was only 17 at the time, and another petite victim seemingly snatched off the street. They still don't have any idea what happened to her. Now, many think these killings and disappearances could be related, carried out by easy access to main highways across adjoining counties. One attorney, Mark Krumbane, who's worked with many murderers, believes he's gained a good eye for spotting patterns, M.O.s, and criminal behavior. He thinks there's a serial killer at work, and certainly there could be. Now, this next young lady, her name was Samantha, was just 18, working as part of a group of young people who were traveling from town to town selling magazine subscriptions. She and her boyfriend at the time thought it'd be a great road trip, a way to see America, but it was a hard job. They're on their feet all day, and it was hard to get people to buy the magazine offers. And if they didn't make sales, they'd be fired, so the pressure was constant. No fun involved at all, and at the end of the day, they'd collapse exhausted in her hotel room. One day, not long after joining the team, they decided they'd had enough and left the group in Sacramento. Samantha called her mother and said they were stuck there and that they only had enough money for one night in the motel room. Her mother offered to buy her a plane ticket, but her daughter said they wanted to go to her boyfriend's parents, so she bought her and her boyfriend bus tickets to get to his parents, and they went to stay there. After a while, though, his mother wasn't happy for him to live there and not work, so with a great reluctance, they found himself having to rejoin the magazine crew. Back with their old jobs, they were approached by a rival group who were doing the same kind of job, and the bosses of that group offered them a job. They met some of the new group and chatted with them for a while, decided to try their luck with them, and maybe the job would be easier. That evening, two of the girls in a new group asked him if they wanted to go and see a movie in town. Boyfriend was tired and didn't feel like it, but Samantha said she'd go. Later, when the group returned from the movie, Samantha wasn't with them. They all said she got up from her seat crying in the middle of the movie and ran out. They claimed not to know anything else. They didn't know where she'd gone. Her boyfriend couldn't believe that none of them even followed her to see if she was okay. And none of them knew her. They'd only just met her. She also couldn't understand why she'd be crying. She left in a good mood. Nothing was troubling her that he knew about. Well, he went down to the movie theater himself and asked if any of the employees had seen her running out crying, and they said they hadn't. So he walked back looking for her all the way from the town back to the hotel. Didn't see any sign of her. Despite her boyfriend asking everybody he came across if they'd seen her, nobody seemed to know anything about her. And the he phoned her mother in a panic and is surprised by what she tells him. She explains to him her daughter has a history of running away. Her mother says she's done it a lot of times in the past, and she'd been through it many times before. She said she first started running away when she was about 13, when her mother remarried. 2 years went by with her heartbroken mother contacting every missing persons organization for help with trying to find her daughter. Unfortunately, the details have been entered incorrectly into the missing person databases. Although no one knew this at the time, it meant her case just would not flare up. Then, after 2 years, a policeman noticed a report that had come in on the day after she'd gone missing, in which a girl had been hit by cars on a freeway and killed. Well, the description matched hers, but they didn't know that at the time because she wasn't coming up in the missing persons database. Now, the death had been extremely strange because investigators discovered she'd apparently run straight into the road into the oncoming cars. Her pockets had been turned inside out as though they'd been emptied. So, you have to ask yourself, had somebody gone through her pockets after she'd been hit? Did it happen before? And why? What were they looking for? What had they taken, if anything? Why had she run straight into the cars, making it impossible for them not to hit her? One driver who'd spotted her just moments before she'd been hit described her expression as being blank as she ran in the path of the oncoming cars. Looked like she'd been in a daze, as though not even noticing the cars coming straight after her. Now, the police couldn't understand what she was doing on the highway. Had she been dropped off from her vehicle? It was I-10. One of California's busiest freeways. No pedestrian path there. She could have been dropped off by a car, making an illegal and dangerous stop. Or she could have jumped out of the car. But if that was the case, why was her face expressionless, not full of fear and adrenaline? And nobody could say where she'd come from. She'd been running along the center divider in the direction of the flow of traffic. Had then left that central divider and run headlong into the traffic on the other side of the road that was coming directly toward her. Investigators wondered if the impact of being hit by the car had caused her pockets to become turned out. They know that shoes had been ripped off in crashes, but they weren't so sure about the pockets. Well, when the autopsy was done, she was found to have traces of amphetamine, cocaine, and alcohol in her system. But when the investigating officer read the toxicology report, he didn't think the levels of the drugs and alcohol are high enough to have influenced her behavior that night. It was just literally trace amounts. But her behavior and death remain a complete mystery. Now, it's not just people in the lower echelon of society that become mysteries. This next one, whose name was Margaret, was a researcher and cardiologist at Columbia University. And according to her, she just managed to make an amazing breakthrough in medical research. She was clearly unbelievably happy, and it said that she told the shopkeepers near her holiday home she's going to be announcing her breakthrough to the press very soon. She left the shop with her groceries and took them back to her vacation home in Nantucket. It's January 1980. The next morning, her brother arrived to escort her to church, and he couldn't find her. It was freezing outside, but her boots were still in the house, as well as her jacket, and her car was still in the garage. Her brother looked everywhere for her, but she wasn't in the house, and she wasn't outside the house. He was puzzled, but presumed she may have gone for a walk in other clothing. Well, there was no sign of her that day or the day after, and in fact, she was missing. The really strange thing was that her brother then found a pile of clothing arranged in neat order along with her passport sitting on top and some cash in a part of the house that had already been checked the previous day, and they hadn't been there before. They were summer clothes and totally unsuited to winter. They had no idea who had piled things there. His sister was nowhere to be seen. Her car hadn't been moved, and it was too cold to survive outside in January for several days without shelter. Her brother decided that perhaps she'd committed suicide and walked into the sea beside the house and drowned, but if she did, who put the pile of clothes, cash, and the passport in an area that had already been searched and found to be empty? Whatever may have been the truth of the matter, she was never seen again. Well, this next case involved Mr. Charles Romer and his wife. They were fairly well-to-do. They were en route to their summer home in Miami. And after a long day on the road, they decided it was time to pull over and check into a hotel for the night and get some sleep. They found one of the hotels, a chain hotel, nothing very cheap, but not high class either. One that would just serve its purpose of a bed for the night. Parked their Lincoln in the hotel car park and checked in, went straight to their room to freshen up before dinner. It was April 1980. They left their room to go to dinner that evening. Vanished. A chambermaid noticed 3 days later the room appeared to have been unused, but all the couple's belongings were still inside. Their luggage was still in the rooms, along with other personal paperwork and a bottle of whiskey. The beds had not been slept in. When they checked in, it was thought the well-off couple had been wearing jewelry that was quite expensive. Police were alerted that day, and although a search was started, it was probably too late to get any real lead on what had possibly happened to the couple 3 days before. One witness claimed to have seen their distinctive car traveling on the highway about an hour after they checked in, but that couldn't be corroborated. If it had been their car, were the couple in it? That seemed unlikely, unless they'd been abducted because they had no reason in their personal or family life to want to disappear. Financially very secure and had no money problems and lived a very comfortable life. They had children with whom they were in regular contact, and relations were good. It's unlikely now they could still be alive because they weren't young at the time of their disappearance. In fact, the children had their father declared legally dead in order for them to settle the estate 5 years after they disappeared. So the questions, was somebody envious of their wealth and greed that led them to rob the couple? And why did they have to do that to a couple who did no harm to anybody and by all accounts were well-liked and kept themselves to themselves? And why did they have to take the couple even if they did rob them? But despite the most intensive of searches on land and in the water, with both local and statewide investigations, including the FBI, no trace whatsoever could be found. No real leads came in, just tips that led nowhere and speculation. The family hired private detectives who thoroughly searched and couldn't find any resolution. Looks like nobody will ever know what happened to the couple. But there is a suspicion that foul play may have played a part, because otherwise how could two adults simply vanish in her hotel room one evening and never be seen again? And was there an involvement from members of the hotel staff? How did the abductors manage to get him out of the hotel without being seen? And why was their custom-made car never seen again either? Well, this is another interesting case. Almost 70 years ago, there was another strange disappearance, this time at a hotel in Jacksonville, Illinois. Mr. and Mrs. Campbell had driven there to visit their son, who was a teacher at the college in town. When they checked into their hotel for the night, their son joined them for a while, but his father was so tired they became concerned he might actually be ill because he seemed almost disoriented. And they called a doctor to come and check him out. Well, the doctor examined him thoroughly, but found him only to be very tired and prescribed a medication to give him a good night's sleep. Well, the father took that medication after his son left, and he and his wife settled in their room for the night. Medication didn't seem to be working because he seemed more anxious. Asked her a couple of times if their car was locked outside in the parking lot. She assured him it was and suggested he try to sleep, and she fell asleep quickly. When she awoke suddenly in the middle of the night, she felt the bed for her husband, expecting to find him flat out asleep, but she was shocked to discover both the bed and the room were empty. Nothing apart from her husband seemed to be missing. The car keys, his clothing, and wallet were still in the room, even his glasses, and he needed those glasses to navigate. The worried wife quickly called the police, and a search was carried out of the local area that was to last for the next 3 days. Helicopters searched from the air. Firefighters dredged the creeks. Even the students in the local college helped the search for him. He was a big man, had a limp, was in his pajamas. He should have been easily found. But nobody saw a sign of him. Well, reports came in about possible sightings, but they all turned out to be false alarms. Only one of the possible lead came in according to the Illinois Times, and it came from a psychic who said he'd be found at a distance of 7 miles away. The newspaper says the authorities did check out the report from a farmer who lived at exactly that distance from the hotel, and it told him he'd been awakened during the night by the man's disappearance, by men shouting in his field. Police searched all over his land, but they didn't find any clues, no evidence anybody had been there. Even the FBI got involved, came up empty-handed. The family themselves spent practically every penny they had trying to find out what happened to the man. But there were no clues. He's still missing. Well, here's another couple for you. Edward and Stephanie, husband and wife, attended an evening party at a hotel in Chicago suburbs one Friday, 1970. After having only just arrived, Edward began to say he wasn't feeling well, though he believed it was because he hadn't eaten dinner and he was hungry. There were only appetizers at the party, and they thought they should leave, so they said their goodbyes and made their way back to the hotel and back to their car. Nobody knew anything was wrong until Monday, when neither one showed up for work. A neighbor gave the police a key to enter their home, and the police got no response to the knock on their front door. Their car was not in the drive. The newspapers are still on the lawn. Everything inside the house appeared neat and tidy. Nothing indicated there had been a robbery or any other kind of disturbance inside the house, but it was strangely empty. Since that morning, neither the husband's nor the wife's bank accounts have been used. Both worked within the financial industry and were said to be very responsible and hardworking individuals. weren't known to have any enemies and certainly no ties to criminal elements. Nobody could understand what had happened. It was just an ordinary couple who vanished. Police believe it could be possible that after Edwards said he was feeling unwell, it may have impaired his driving ability and they had crashed. But an investigation did not reveal any car wrecks in the area. They also thought it possible he might have accidentally driven off the bridge since he had to go across the Charles River to get home. So they searched the river extensively, but didn't find any sign of a car in the water. In fact, when the river was dredged 10 years later, while the authorities did find cars, they didn't find the one belonging to the couple who were missing in these strange circumstances. An anonymous tip that came in nearly 25 years after they disappeared told authorities the couple had been murdered and their bodies dumped in a pond in Illinois. Police followed up that lead by searching the pond specified in the anonymous tip, but they didn't find any bodies and no car. If the husband had indeed been impaired in his driving due to feeling a bit off color, where'd the car end up? How do a car and two people simply vanished? It was a registered and easily identifiable car. There's never any sign of it after the couple disappeared. They hadn't been in a remote location where perhaps a car could be hidden in the woods or on farmland. They were in suburbs of a major city. As Ron Van Ralt, a retired investigator, commented, two people don't just vanish off the face of the earth. There's got to be more to the story. Well, let's turn to the story of Curtis Pissen. Been a policeman for more than 10 years in a New Hampshire state, till progressive multiple sclerosis had forced him to leave the job. And at the relatively young age of 40, he was working as a security guard to pay the bills. He was working at a factory in the year 2000, doing night shifts. On this particular night, his supervisor went to look for him, but couldn't find him. After thoroughly searching the factory, his supervisor couldn't find any sign of him at all. And he didn't expect him to have walked far away from his post because his medical condition meant he couldn't get around very well. And he was severely limited in the distance he could walk. And everyone's first thoughts was that the man had decided to end it all. His car had mysteriously been set on fire earlier in the shift, and firefighters had to be called to put it out. It was ruined. Had a serious medical problem, it was known, as causing the field depressed, but if that were the case, where was the body? He couldn't have walked far, so why couldn't they find him? Inside the premises, a door and a vending machine appeared to have been damaged, but in spite of a thorough search, they still couldn't find him. And how had his co-workers heard nothing? And that one made him wonder, had somebody come into the factory and done something to him? Had they kidnapped him? But if that's the case, why did nobody hear anything? Well, many years later, one of the security team been working that night was arrested for an unrelated matter, and rumors then flew around he confessed to killing the ex-cop. But again, if he did, where was the body? It's likely this was just rumor because he was never arrested for murdering the man, and there was no evidence to go on. Police were clearly baffled by the case, and there's never been an answer what happened that night or where the Curtis Pissen had gone. Well, this next case involved two men who went missing on the same day. Charles' body being exhumed for forensic examination and an ex-wife who couldn't be found. This was involved in the life of tow truck company boss Randall Wright.
Excuse me.
The Potomac local newspapers even had enough of the countless unfounded speculation and accusations about him. He says he's been thoroughly slandered. The detectives aren't so sure, though. And chances are, if they could pin something on him, they would. One of the detectives investigating the strange, disturbing disappearances and the deaths have been quoted as saying, "There's a common thread here. It's pretty obvious. It seems everybody he comes in contact with is gone." Well, this story began when two of his employees vanished on exactly the same day in 1993. And they both made claims against his company for compensation. One of them, Paul Armstrong, had last been seen by his girlfriend as she went out the front door of their home that morning to go to work. Steve Lombard was due to meet his wife in town to go shopping. Both men vanished. After employee Paul Armstrong's girlfriend went to work, his brother called about an hour later, but Paul wasn't there. Well, his brother let himself in, but while he didn't find Paul, he did find his wallet. And his brother didn't meet his girlfriend for lunch. The man's co-worker, Steve, had left his house and driven to their workplace to collect his paycheck. But due to a clerical error, he didn't get that check. It wasn't known what happened to him after that, but he never got to meet with his wife later to do the shopping. The next day, his truck was found in a grocery store parking lot. Keys were inside it, along with a cold cup of coffee. And they weren't the only ones to disappear. Seems no one actually knew that his ex-wife had disappeared down in Mexico where they owned another house. The truck company boss didn't alert authorities, and it was only when the Merced County Sheriff's found out about it they filed the missing persons report themselves. Neither man was ever seen again, nor was his ex-wife. So he's just a very unlucky man. He believes he is, but authorities think there's more to it than that. Well, there's a number of unbelievably mysterious disappearances. How does someone just vanish? It is true that every year several hundred thousand people disappear. Most are voluntary disappearances, but quite a number on their own just go poof and are never seen again. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night for another pre-recorded show, and then beginning the evening of the 2nd, I'll be doing it live. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.